today on Against the Grain. During the so-called Pink Tide, left-leaning governments proliferated throughout much of Latin America. Elizabeth J. Friedman's new book examines what the Pink Tide accomplished in the arenas of gender and sexuality. I'm CS. You'll hear me in conversation with the University of San Francisco professor coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. It was about a decade and a half, a time when people on the left around the world looked with hope and expectation toward Latin America. Country after country in that region had installed a leftist or center-left government. And you probably know some of the names: Hugo Chavez in Venezuela, Evo Morales in Bolivia, Daniel Ortega in Nicaragua, Rafael Correa in Ecuador. Looking back fondly on the Pink Tide is one thing. Investigating what was actually achieved during this era of left governance is another. Now, the question of what the Pink Tide accomplished is a big one, with a very long answer. But an important part of that answer has been supplied by a new book called Seeking Rights from the Left: Gender, Sexuality, and the Latin American Pink Tide. The book's editor, Elizabeth J. Friedman, is professor of politics and Latin American studies at the University of San Francisco. Elizabeth's book examines the extent to which the Pink Tide advanced a gender and sexual justice agenda on issues like abortion, LGBT recognition, violence against women, women's representation in federal legislatures, and same-sex marriage. When Elizabeth J. Friedman joined me recently in our studios, I asked how much of Latin America, by the early 2000s, was ruled by left-leaning governments.
Well, the figure that a lot of people like to use is that by 2010, two-thirds of Latin American populations were living under governments that leaned left. And I like how you put it, leaned left, because, of course, they leaned more or less acutely in that direction.
So what is the range of left orientations that might be included within left as describing the Pink Tide?
So in the introduction, I believe we say a range of lefts, including liberals, socialists, social democratic, decolonial. It really was quite a spread.
So what is the kind of the general years that describe the Pink Tide, that encompass the Pink Tide, and what were the years that were the focus of this book?
So people usually date the Pink Tide by sort of the end of the 90s, because some of those countries sort of came on the line as left-leaning by 1998 or so. And then right now there is a big debate about whether it is in fact, well, I don't know if there's a debate about whether it's over. I think it is over. We're not quite sure what's next, but that's about 2015. And certainly for the purposes of any of the statistics that we use in this volume, we're talking about 2000 to 2015.
How much has the Pink Tide been interpreted as a response to neoliberalism and to what neoliberalism did to people's lives?
Well, I think it has been interpreted very heavily as a response to neoliberalism and what neoliberalism did in terms of people's economic situation, their aspirations and dreams for their families, and what they were or were not going to be able to do under the conditions of neoliberalism. But I think it was also very much a response to the promises that neoliberalism offered, or that neoliberals offered, and how those promises really did not come true again for the majority of Latin Americans. And of course, I know you know that Latin America is, I believe, still the world region with the worst income inequality. So when we're thinking about majorities in Latin America, we're thinking about middle class, but mainly lower middle class, popular folks, grassroots, people in acute poverty. And at the time of the sort of the turn to the left, many countries had, well, not all of these countries had majorities in poverty, but there were significant minorities living in poverty and the sort of retreat of the state that characterized neoliberalism was not doing them any favors.
What promises did Pink Tide administrations, I guess either when they were campaigning for office or once they were in office, what promises did they make about inequality and the extent to which inequality would be addressed?
Right. So one of the points of this collection, and I think bringing in 14 people, right, to work simultaneously on a common set of questions, is to say how varied these experiences were. And of course, in the book, we cover 8 different countries in depth, as well as having sort of the background of the Pink Tide in general. And so the promises, the political projects of these countries really did vary. And the authors have done a wonderful job in offering that kind of context from country to country. But at the same time, we thought it was a fair intellectual and sort of activist project to bring the countries into dialogue with each other, because there were a general set of promises that these left-leaning movements and administrations made. And they were really rooted in the at least amelioration of the deep-seated inequalities that transect Latin America and have historically. And I think fundamentally those promises were often geared around income inequality and poverty, but they weren't limited to that. So, you know, in our social science jargon and political science jargon, we often talk about representation, recognition, and redistribution. And there were promises made on all three of these axes, right? So the one, redistribution, was the one that I think was common to all of these, or, you know, somewhere in the platform of all of those who came to power as part of this left tide. And then to varying degrees, there were also promises around recognition and representation. So other ways of including excluded minorities or majorities into politics, in social life, acknowledging themselves, their existence, their languages, their families, right, that kind of thing.
Specifically on the issue of poverty and inequality, what did Pink Tide governments do to reduce inequality? What were some of the more remarkable achievements in the area of addressing extreme poverty?
Yeah, well, I think the remarkable achievements were really focusing very directly on poverty as a social issue that needed to be addressed in itself, for itself, as a, you know, sort of a fundamental part of this project. And they were often quite successful. And I'll talk about sort of one of the major sort of ways that this policy was addressed. So the percentage of people living in extreme poverty under left-leaning governments was reduced in every one of these cases, of the ones that lasted for more than a half an administration or one administration, right? And of course, there are secular trends we have to think about here as well. And you can imagine that academics get into all sorts of arguments about who was really responsible for bringing down that poverty. Nonetheless, there is a very clear correlation that if you look at what was happening under the left in Latin America, that extreme poverty was reduced quite remarkably. And often in places where acute poverty was, you know, as high as 40-45%, those rates also tumbled down often to below 20%. So this is a real achievement. And as the Pink Tide was developing, it was very clear that this was going to be a, if not perhaps the major achievement, that for a time, poverty really was being, you know, actively worked on in a successful way by these governments. Now, in terms of how they worked on it, the anti-poverty policies that the collaborators in this collection focus on are the ones that were specifically directed at those living often in the worst economic conditions. And that policy was one that was common to, I think, almost all of the cases in this book, called a conditional cash transfer. Sometimes it wasn't as conditional as other times. But this is a welfare measure that literally has representatives of the government handing out a monthly stipend to poor heads of households. And poor heads of households in Latin America are predominantly female. So poor women who have children were given a cash handout once a month. The conditionality part of that was that they agreed to meet certain standards where it came to the care of their children. Those tended to be monthly or half-yearly checks in the clinic, vaccinations, and making sure that their kids went to school every day.
So this money was given out on condition to these women. How successful were conditional cash transfers in terms of alleviating poverty and specifically helping poor women and their families?
What the data show is that when we're thinking about rates of poverty coming way down under the left, they also came down quite dramatically for female heads of households. So it was successful in terms of the data. Now, of course, there's another side to that story, which is covered in really wonderful, often ethnographic detail in some of these chapters. And that was, if you will, the way in which this policy measure was deliberately targeted at women was simultaneously something that had come out of the feminist economic policy literature as an effective way to support poor children and poor women, with the acknowledgement that giving money directly to mothers was a very effective way of making sure that it benefited their children. But at the same time, there was a reification or a reinforcement of women's roles in their households as primarily an instrument for the uplift of their children.
That's Elizabeth J. Friedman. She joins us in studio on Against the Grain. My name is C.S. Song. She is professor of politics and Latin American studies at the University of San Francisco. And we are talking about her new edited volume. It's called Seeking Rights from the Left, Gender, Sexuality, and the Latin American Pink Tide, recently out from Duke University Press. Right, and this seems to be one of the themes of your book, that certain programs, social programs, programs often directed at women, didn't necessarily address fundamental structures within society that may have, for example, denigrated women. So could you talk more about that? Why have, for example, many feminists been critical of conditional cash transfers, even though this is money that goes to poor women, head of households?
Absolutely. And I appreciate your recognition that feminists who often are active in policy arenas in these very countries were simultaneously very enthusiastic about anti-poverty policy that took women into account, that acknowledged the realities of their lives, but at the same time were quite concerned about the way in which women were effectively instrumentalized in these policies. Because I think the policy prescriptions that feminist policymakers were interested in is, how can we build anti-poverty programs that will take women's roles seriously, but also think about enabling the development of women as individuals or community members in ways that didn't always link and lock them to the well-being of their children. So that, obviously, that was a very important part of these women's lives, but at the same time, so was developing as individuals, getting education themselves, having work opportunities, sharing reproductive tasks in their families, perhaps extended families. But most of these programs instead, again, effectively use these women as conduits to try to support their children's well-being. The other thing that happened with quite a lot of these programs in terms of the pragmatic, how do you carry this out, is that managing the conditional cash transfer was added to women's daily unpaid reproductive labor. So in addition to that, in some of the cases in the collection, what the researchers observed and learned were that besides having women be conduits for the uplift of their children and adding that, the sort of bureaucratic engagements that they had to have to their unpaid reproductive labor, they were also asked to perform significant amounts of community and political labor, again, largely unpaid, on top of those responsibilities.
Right, and unpaid labor and women's unpaid labor, this is another recurrent theme in this book and in the introduction you've co-authored to this book. And there were, of course, revolutionary and reformist efforts throughout the Latin American Pink Tide. For example, in Venezuela, you write that often these revolutionary initiatives would rely on unpaid women's labor. Can you talk about that?
Absolutely. So in cases such as Venezuela under Chavez, as well as Ecuador under Correa, these very powerful leaders would often refer to their revolutions as having a woman's face. And certainly in some of their discourse, they would acknowledge the protagonism that particularly poor women or, you know, previously marginalized women could and they wanted to encourage to have in their revolutionary political projects. And that, of course, was very inspirational and not unimportant in terms of validating activists and communities to think, wow, we are being asked to contribute here and stepping up for that. But at the same time, for example, in Venezuela, there was an assumption that particularly poor women who are already managing all of these things and, you know, sort of working in the informal labor market, largely responsible for their children, tasks in their communities, were then repeatedly asked to also perform unpaid political labor, turning out for the rallies. And as you probably remember, under Chavez, there was one election after another. And one of the things that happened under Chavez was making room for communities to come together to figure out what their central, often economic or their priorities in terms of development projects. Right. And there was infrastructure put in place to try to support communities with autonomous decision making and then carrying out these various kinds of development projects for themselves. But again, there was this assumption that women had this sort of particularly poor women had this elasticity to their unpaid labor where they could take on, again, beyond the reproductive labor they're performing in their homes, effectively reproductive labor in the community and political arenas as well.
You point out in this introduction to your book, Seeking Rights from the Left, that, you know, there were many obstacles and many of them rooted in the history of these countries, historical ideologies of these countries that feminist and women's and queer movements had to push against. Could you talk about the extent to which countries in Latin America historically have promoted both traditional roles and heterosexuality as part of kind of building or constructing or being a nation, and also the machismo that informed a lot of gender relations up to that point, and perhaps, and you can tell me whether this is true, continuing through and beyond the Pink Tide?
Yes, I'll start with the machismo aspect. I'm not an anthropologist. And I think there is some wonderful work on contextualized gender relations, not just in Latin America as an entire region, but of course, sub-regions, individual countries, and then of course, there are urban-rural dynamics, that these are much more fluid, I think, than from the outside and sort of the down and dirty idea that machismo looks like one thing across this enormous really diverse set of interlocking, you know, social situations, conditions, communities. So with that said, many people will trace patriarchal dominance back to the dynamics of both the Spanish and Portuguese colonial era, ideals that were brought in by the Spaniards and the Portuguese in terms of the way society should look, the models particularly that were offered women, how close they should try to model themselves on the Virgin Mary as the ultimate figure of what it meant to be a good woman, sacrificing yourself entirely for your children, and understanding your role in a hierarchy that is always directed from the top down by a very, very powerful man, including the Christian God. And then, of course, how that was interpreted through Spanish society and what happened with the mixing of societies when the Spaniards and the Portuguese came, also brought slaves, right, and then interacted, and you can see my air quotes there, with local populations. So gender dynamics certainly are rooted in that encounter of peoples and cultures. But then in terms of what happened in politics with male dominance, what you see, again, in different ways in different political institutions is this way in which gender becomes embedded in the very structure of constitutions, political parties, right, the structure of the state, assumptions about who, you know, should and should not be political actors, at what level. And so, you know, we talk about the institutionalization of patriarchal politics.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Elizabeth J. Friedman teaches politics and Latin American studies at the University of San Francisco. She's the author of several books, including Interpreting the Internet, Feminist and Queer Counterpublics in Latin America, and Unfinished Transitions, Women and the Gender Development of Democracy in Venezuela, 1936 to 1996. We are talking about her new book. It's an edited volume. It's called Seeking Rights from the Left, Gender, Sexuality, and the Latin American Pink Tide. And it looks at eight countries and what happened to gender and sexuality in those countries from about 2000 to the year 2015. Those eight countries are Argentina, Bolivia, Brazil, Chile, Ecuador, Nicaragua, Uruguay, and Venezuela. And also working against, although you find some nuance, quite a bit of nuance in this, is conservative religious institutions in these various countries, which one might assume are and were generally opposed to left and center-left projects and reforms. What did you find out about the extent to which religious institutions held back progressive reform?
That's a fantastic question, because what we found was that the dynamics between particularly the institutional aspects of the Catholic Church and sometimes Pentecostal evangelical churches, the institutional relationships between church hierarchies or, say, politicians who see themselves as part of religious, right-wing religious movements, and leftist governors, leftist rulers, is something that was of such importance to the issues that we cover in this book. When we turn to issues of gender and sexuality, the role of religious movements and, again, the sort of institutional hierarchical church was absolutely fundamental in how much space there was for gender and sexuality justice. And that was quite variable across these countries. It wasn't absent in any of these countries.
You would think that the church would be more opposed to certain reforms or revolutionary initiatives that threatened conservative notions of family and nation. and then maybe be less opposed or less staunchly opposed to other reforms. Is that fair to say?
Yes, I think that's fair to say. I think it's fair to say that women's reproductive autonomy and bodily autonomy when it comes to reproduction is still virulently opposed by traditional religious leaders and their extensive followers and movements, and that it shows how deeply embedded in, as you say, the idea of the nation itself, the traditional family is, that women's reproductive autonomy is seen as threatening what's often called la célula básica de la sociedad, the basic cell of society. That if you think of the nuclear family as being the basic cell of society, and then you say women are going to control what happens biologically with that family, then it is seen as threatening the whole thing from the basic building block. So abortion is the policy on which there has been the least movement under the left. And in the cases where not only abortion, but some of the other policy demands on the part of feminist and LGBTQ, they're known as sexually gender diverse movements, that different movements in different local and national contexts self-identify in a lot of different ways. But the countries in which they've had the least success tend to be countries where very powerful leaders that don't have a lot of accountability mechanisms built in to their political actions have made common cause or strategic alliances with religious leaders and movements.
Would you say the issue then is in part about the strength of the executive in various countries, or is it the strength of the executive in conjunction with their willingness to ally themselves with conservative forces like religious institutions?
I would say the latter. That's a really interesting question, because and we do see this variation in the countries that are covered in the collection, that on the far end of the progressive scale, you have Ecuador and Nicaragua. And these are places where you have powerful, in many ways, largely unaccountable executives who have deliberately made themselves more powerful over time, whether that's through constitutional reform, whether that's through the way that they've structured their political support, that they have made alliances with religious leaders. And then that has been a nearly impossible situation, not only to push forward on progressive gender and sexuality-based policy, but often for the very survival of, say, feminist collectivities, right? Daniel Ortega effectively declared war on the Nicaraguan feminist movement. And Correa also.
Of Ecuador.
Yeah, of Ecuador. He at some point, the author of that chapter, Annie Wilkinson, talks about how there were, you know, sort of this time in which he was accusing feminists of promoting this gender ideology that was going to, you know, sort of obliterate the family as we know it, and really deliberately targeting feminists. And in both cases, that was happening while they were making strategic alliances, often probably for additional supporters. Ortega seemed to have a conversion, he and his wife, Murillo, right? And of course, they were married by the archbishop and that kind of thing. And so there was this conversion that ended up to be quite damaging for the prospects of gender and sexuality justice.
That's the voice of Elizabeth J. Friedman, professor of politics and Latin American studies at the University of San Francisco. We'll take a short break and speak more with her about her new volume, Seeking Rights from the Left. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. Elizabeth J. Friedman teaches at the University of San Francisco, and her new volume is an edited volume called Seeking Rights from the Left, Gender, Sexuality, and the Latin American Pink Tide. It's published by Duke University Press. The book looks at the extent to which left governance in the Pink Tide administrations of Latin America has made a difference or not on issues of gender and sexuality. And she and Constanza Tabush have written the introduction to the volume, a very rich introduction that lays out a lot of the findings of the various contributors who are writing about the eight nations addressed in this book. There's so many things to talk about here, Elizabeth. And of course, people can pick up Seeking Rights from the Left and get a lot more. But I do want to specifically ask about Uruguay, because this is a country that is sort of off the radar screen of any media in the U.S. And I think it's the first chapter in this book, and you do structure the book, if I'm correct, in terms of sort of most encouraging to least encouraging in the arenas of gender and sexuality. So what happened in Uruguay that you and at least the contributor who wrote about Uruguay, or were there a number of them? You could maybe pronounce their names better than I can. What did you find and they find so encouraging about what happened in that nation?
Okay, well, thank you for giving me an opportunity to talk a bit about this case, because as you say, it does start the collection in part because of the path-breaking policy changes that happened in Uruguay during this time, which include gender identity legislation in 2009, that is so that individuals have the power without proving somehow medically that they have changed their gender, to be known legally by the gender that they identify with. Same-sex marriage was also made nationally available and legalized in 2013. And then nearly uniquely in the region at the national level, abortion was decriminalized in the first trimester in 2012. So those look like major pieces of the gender and sexuality justice puzzle in the region. And there is no other country that has achieved all three of these.
So what might explain the progress, the significant, the almost startling progress of this country?
So the three collaborators from Uruguay, all of whom are based in and around the country, Nikki Johnson, Ana Laura Rodriguez Gusta, and Diego Sempol, I think that they would explain why these changes have happened in Uruguay by noting the strategic ways in which the social movements that were promoting these changes worked with allies inside of the state, on the one hand, and also figured out how to discuss and advocate for these changes in language that made sense to Uruguayan populations. And in fact, those two conclusions are conclusions that we find in several of the chapters. If they're present, progress has been made. If they're absent, it's been much harder.
So what would be an example in Uruguay of the second factor, which sounds like framing demands in ways that might be more attractive or appealing to the general public?
Absolutely. The wonderful case of framing that they bring forward in Uruguay has to do with the way that LGBT collectivities expanded the coalition within which they were working in civil society by recognizing that they were part of a sort of a civic move for many demands for rights and justice. And the illustration of this that I just adore is that one year they changed the gay pride parade, because gay pride parades happen all over Latin America. They're actually popular and quite common. And they changed the name to the Diversity March. And the next year, it was much bigger, and what the march stood for was much broader. So there was this sense of framing the demands in demands that many people could agree with, that weren't so specifically tailored to a particular collectivity. We want marriage because we are gay, right? But we demand democratic rights for citizenship, as do so many other people. So that was a very successful strategy on their part. And of course, as with the other chapters, the authors of this chapter are very careful to contextualize what was happening with the Uruguayan left, which is an institutionalized left that has been in power for some time, that these struggles were not easy struggles, but also not everything looks as rosy as it seems. So, for example, if I may, the decriminalization of abortion in Uruguay, which is just nearly unparalleled, right? Because abortion is legal or decriminalized in the first trimester only in Cuba, Mexico City, and Uruguay in Latin America. So, tremendous achievement. But because there were, even at the end of the long negotiation, from the leftist coalition, there were defections from the party when it came to pushing forward the law. There was a negotiation with a party that I forget at this point, but was either center or even center right. And a couple of legislators from that party were able to put their tweaks, if you will, in the legislation so that there is a waiting period and counseling that women have to go through before they can have the procedure. Moreover, my understanding that in Uruguay, it's not that abortion is legal in the first trimester. It's that it has been decriminalized in those first 12 weeks. So it is still considered a crime with the penalties lifted in the first trimester. So you can see how, right, even what looks to the outside like this tremendous achievement with respect to women's reproductive autonomy in the Latin American region still was the product of much struggle and at the end a compromise that many people were dismayed by.
You mentioned the other factor that encouraged or spurred progress in Uruguay as being sort of the coalition building, the collaboration between state actors and non-state actors, by which I assume you mean like activists and movements. Can you talk a little bit about that and also describe how important you found that and the contributors found that to be important throughout Latin America, that the more collaborations there were between the state, between government officials, say, or government agencies and non-state organizations or movements, how important that was to effecting progressive or radical change? And also, when we talk about government in that context, are we talking about government administrations, or I see references in this introduction to women's agencies, like state women's agencies. What are the more common collaborations between?
Great. So the wonderful sentence that encapsulates this, well, at least wonderful for nerdy social scientists, in the Uruguayan case is that, you know, sort of the key strategic organizational move that they made there was the consolidation of a multimodal policy network. So allow me to unpack that.
Please.
With reference to your wonderful questions here. So I'll just take it word by word. Consolidation meant that this organizational strategy that the actors involved came up with was consolidated in that it was a network that continued in some form, could be come back to, could be relied on beyond one sort of round of policy negotiation and achievement. So it's consolidated, but multimodal means that it happened in a lot of different places and possibly in different ways in the different places for this policy network. So to get back to the other part of this question, what that would mean was that activists based in civil society, so part of social movements, part of non-governmental organizations, civic lobby groups, feminist organizations, LGBT groups, that individuals from these groups would make strategic connections with individuals in a range of governmental positions. So the ones that I think people are most used to thinking about are legislators who maybe they came out of a movement, right? Or were their friends or simply were legislators who were open to these demands that they wanted to put forward as well. And certainly making those connections is absolutely key, that movement activists outside of the state find their interlocutors, their allies inside the legislative branch. However, in Latin America, often because of partisan infighting or because, say, a left executive has come to power, but left parties are, you know, not in power in a legislature, that the legislature is not the only pathway in which to build this network. And so other nodes in the policy network also include people in other areas of the state, sometimes in the judiciary, right? Judges that are open to taking on strategic cases. That's a very important thing that happened, particularly around the recognition of same-sex relationships. And then you mentioned things called national women's offices. It's often called women's policy machinery, you know, all of this jargon. But in any case, it's like as if in the United States we had a Department for Gender Affairs. Doesn't that sound amazing? Well, maybe it kind of would depend on who's in charge of the government, right?
True.
But in other words, so there is a specific ministry that is put in place to attend to issues having to do with women or having to do with gender relations. And there are different configurations of a department like that in nearly every Latin American country, often instantiated first because of the demands of feminists who, coming out of sort of the wave of democratization that you may have remembered happened, you know, in Latin America in the 80s and 90s, saying we need to make sure we have a space in the state that's open to our demands because we want to be full citizens in this new democracy and we want to make sure our issues don't slide off the agenda. Now, of course, once different presidents come to power, they can make that space more or less congenial for feminist demands. But in any case, whether it's a specific department focused on gender-related issues or another department, you know, focused on social welfare, focused on development, even foreign affairs sometimes, that there are individuals inside of the executive apparatus that are also strategic allies for movement activists. And so in Uruguay, what you see are that this network is a network where people have learned to trust each other, figure out how to work together, and are strategizing together about what the most effective way to push their demands forward might be. This is also the case, and so you asked if, you know, we saw this elsewhere. Absolutely. In fact, attempts at establishing these kinds of relationships happen in all of the cases, and then in some cases they're more successful.
Elizabeth J. Friedman joins me in studio. She's professor of politics and Latin American studies at the University of San Francisco and editor of the new volume Seeking Rights from the Left, Gender, Sexuality, and the Latin American Pink Tide. So because we don't have a lot of time left, I'm going to try and summarize what the introduction says about political representation of women in national legislatures in Pink Tide government. So basically, there was at some point an effort to have more women, have more females in these national legislatures. And there were, in some cases, quotas adopted in certain Latin American countries. And so there was a marked increase in the number of women, women representatives, women elected representatives in these countries. Some Latin American governments were eager or inclined to adopt quotas in the 1990s because they wanted to show the world that they were modern democracies. So one might be tempted, Elizabeth, to think of that higher levels of women's representation in a particular country means better progress on women's rights. Is that a proper assumption?
Unfortunately not. It is true that several countries in the Pink Tide, including countries that we cover in this book, have percentages of women in their national legislatures that are at the top of global ranking. The legislature in Bolivia is 53% women. In Argentina and Ecuador, hovering nearly at 40. In Nicaragua, it's 45%. And on the flip side there, and this is a place of a lot of variation, Venezuela is 22%, Chile is 22%, Uruguay is 20%, Brazil is 15%. So, one conclusion, this is not a uniform movement. But the other conclusion is that there is not a correlation where you have high numbers of women in office with the countries that have been working the most effectively to promote gender and sexuality justice. And Nicaragua really stands out here, as does Ecuador. And in the social science jargon, we say that descriptive representation, right, representation that looks like the country, does not equal substantive representation, that is, representation of people's interests.
And you can look at the introduction to this book, Seeking Rights from the Left, for some explanations for why that correlation doesn't hold. So what lessons can social movements and activists learn from what happened in the arenas of gender and sexuality under the Pink Tide?
I think that social movement activists anywhere in the world can learn so much by studying the successes and failures of Latin American social movements on this or really any other issue of deep-seated inequality, because the movements in that region have been active for so long against such tremendous odds. They really are quite inspirational, extraordinarily hardworking. And then they've developed, you know, a lot, in part because these movements have had to confront political contexts with a lot of dynamism, which is a fancy way of saying, you know, there have been authoritarian and democratic moves back and forth in, you know, fairly recent political history. But in terms of what social movements and people who may not consider themselves activists but still support gender and sexuality justice, what they can learn from Latin American movements is really to go back to what we talked about a little bit more in depth in the Uruguayan case, about first how to bring together strategic coalitions where there is room to do so. Because, of course, in some of these contexts, the state is just really closed. And if the state is closed, the state is really closed. But to try to find your interlocutors in different arenas, often in maybe surprising arenas, your allies who can help you move things forward, can help you interpolate what's going on inside of the state. One thing that we see in Latin America is often actors who are, you know, have state-based positions, then move out of them, say, into a non-governmental organization or into the activist space, and then move back in. And so that sort of coalition building is fairly dynamic. And often it's the people themselves that can move things forward, even if they, you know, sort of move arena to arena. But building those multinodal policy networks, I think, is one big takeaway. And then the other one is the strategic framing of movement demands in languages and concepts that resonate with local and national populations. And I think the most famous example of this for these collectivities, as well as so many others in Latin America, is the way that they've used the language of human rights. And I don't want to reify the language of human rights as being somehow the Western interpretation of individuals' political rights. What we see across Latin America is a real dynamism with which they've approached human rights concepts, understandings, to include the human rights of collectivities such as indigenous populations and their rights to land, their rights to language, their rights to their own legal structures, but couched in the idea of human rights, right, which has so much resonance in the Latin American region because of the trauma that they've gone through with authoritarian repression. So I'm not saying, for example, in a U.S. context, human rights is always the sort of discursive key for movements, but looking to your context to think, well, what does it mean in my context to ask for what I'm asking for? What will enable people to hear me or to hear us when we put that demand on the table, and to hear it as an Argentine demand, to hear it as a Venezuelan demand, to hear it as an Uruguayan demand, to hear it as an American demand, as long as we're talking still at the level of the nation state.
Elizabeth J. Friedman, University of San Francisco professor, author of books like Interpreting the Internet, Feminist and Queer Counterpublics in Latin America, and Unfinished Transitions, Women and the Gender Development of Democracy in Venezuela, 1936 to 1996, and editor of the new volume we've been talking about. It's called Seeking Rights from the Left, Gender, Sexuality, and the Latin American Pink Tide. Elizabeth, thanks so much for your work, and thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure, and I love your show.
That means a lot to me. Thanks. And I want to let you know that the book's introduction, co-written by Elizabeth, is available for free online. Go to againstthegrain.org and click on the link we've provided to her book's webpage. And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, and we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.